32. A statue stands. Several weeks earlier, footman and cook had crossed the United States by train and taken a steamship to Hong Kong. There, the real work had begun. It had taken several bribes and days of scouting before they discovered the entrance to the secret shipyard along China's coast on the Yellow Sea. And now they sat on the green mountainside above it, squirreled away behind a cypress tree, drinking cold tea and eating hard tack and dried rice. Footman surveyed the scene below with a spyglass, his eyes still unbelieving. It was a massive shipyard in a perfectly protected cove, and hundreds of workers, mostly European, were labouring with hammers, hauling coal, or tending to various other duties, while heavy cranes moved giant beams of steel and metal plates into position. It was ingeniously hidden. From the ocean it was almost impossible to spot the entrance because of the way it fit into the folds of the mountains. Moreover, the guild had disguised the access with a wooden flotilla that looked, from a distance, like rocks. There were at least 1,000 men working on a multitude of projects. 3 enormous warships were in various states of construction, the Hydra, the Gorgon, and the Medusa. The first 2 were nearly ready to launch. The 3rd looked like the skeleton of a giant beached whale. It was months, if not a good year, away from completion. Footman couldn't help watching in wonder as smaller boats raced at impossible speeds through the waters.
"Stunning, ain't it, mate?"
Cook chewed a dried plum.
"A whopping big operation. You see the little boats? Tritons, they're called. I've never seen anything go that fast on the water."
"Yes, they are impressive."
"They take them out in groups of 2, but they're going straight out into the Pacific, not hugging the mainland. Wherever those little ships go, that's where our mutual enemy resides."
"So we must steal a boat," Footman said, "and follow them."
"I like the way you think, Footman. The question is, how?"
"I have a plan." "I'm all ears," Cook said.
Footman led him back towards the entrance to the bay. It was guarded by sentries in an old pagoda-style tower that perhaps once had been home to monks. It took Footman and Cook 2 hours to make their way down there. The door to the pagoda was closed, and Footman had no idea how many soldiers would be inside.
"I go, you wait," he said. "You're clumsy."
"All too true, Footy. Just shout if you need help."
Footman stole through a line of shrubs and up to the door. It was unlocked, so they weren't expecting an attacker. He opened the door slowly and crept up the stone stairs. The lookout guards were at the top, and judging by their voices, there were at least 2. Soldiers, even the well-trained ones, could not always be focused after hours of staring and waiting. And it was very likely that no one had ever trespassed here. He padded to the top floor and peeked in the door. 1 soldier was staring over the water. 2nd played solitaire on a table. He struck the 1st in the temple with his palm. 2nd received a kick to the side of the skull. They both fell unconscious.
"Shall I come up now?"
Cook asked from the bottom of the pagoda.
"Yes."
Cook was not exactly quiet coming up the stairs, and he clapped his hands when he saw Footman's handiwork.
"Bravo! Wasn't sure if you needed my help or not. They sounded like a bit of trouble."
"No trouble."
Footman had already undressed the shorter man and was pulling on the soldier's grey uniform. Cook changed too, and they waited, briefly debating how long the shifts might be. 1st 1 hour, then another passed.
"Cards?" Cook asked.
Footman shook his head.
"What's your real name?"
Cook said.
"Footman," he answered.
"No, your Chinese one. Sing-songy, innit?"
"I am Footman, that is all."
"Funny thing, Footy. My real name's Cook. Albert Cook. And I became a cook. Destiny, eh?"
Footman shrugged.
"Names are never who you are."
When he first arrived in London, he'd soon noticed that the higher class in England often called their servants by their occupation, not their name. So he took the name Footman. Mr. Socrates had not disagreed, for they knew others would make assumptions about him if that was his name. Assumptions could always be used against the people who made them. Footman had worked for Mr. Socrates for over 20 years. He'd first met his employer in Shanghai and had been hired at the age of 18. Then his name had been Gong Li,
and he trained under the Shaolin masters, warrior monks. He'd completed his years of Qi Kung, of long runs and combat, by carrying a red-hot cauldron down a long alley, balancing the great pot on his forearms. Seals on the cauldron burned a tiger on one arm and a dragon on the other. They still sat there, symbols of his time, training, and beliefs. He had wanted to see the world, so he turned his back on the monks. Mr. Socrates had opened up the world for him. Footman jumped to attention when two of the boats sped towards the exit of the bay. Earlier, they'd seen the lookout soldiers run out and open a section of the camouflaged flotilla, so Footman and Cook knew they should do that. They scurried down and let the first boat pass. It was large enough for 10 men, and was steered using a round wheel with 2 handholds. Triton 12 was painted on its side. When the second boat arrived, Cook put out his hand and signalled stop. The boat, Triton 13, pulled up to the small dock. There were 2 guild soldiers inside, both wearing goggles.
"You want me to handle them?"
Cook whispered. Footman nodded. "What are you stopping us for?" the driver asked.
"Paperwork," Cook said. "Got it right here."
He stepped onto the boat and gave the first one a punch to the skull that dropped him. The second swung, making contact with Cook's shoulder, and was knocked out by Cook's left hand. Cook stripped the men of their goggles, then casually tossed them onto the dock.
"That was a little sloppy," Cook admitted. "But we haven't all been trained in a Shaolin temple, now have we?"
Footman shrugged and jumped on board.
"I'll take the wheel," Cook said.
He needed a few moments of experimentation to learn the controls of the ship, and then they were out on the water, keeping the first boat within sight. The vessel's speed was amazing. It seemed faster than a train as it jumped over each wave. They put on the goggles to protect their eyes from the spray. Footman pointed at the pack of food and bottles of water. There were several boxes of coal next to the firebox, but the coal had been compressed and, he guessed, would last a long time.
"They were expecting a long trip," Cook said. "Not certain I like taking such a small craft out on such a great big ocean, good as its engine is, but I guess we have no choice."
"We don't," Footman agreed.
Cook spun the wheel like he'd piloted the boat his whole life. As the sun set, the lead boat moved farther and farther ahead until it was out of sight. They kept a straight course, following the compass next to the wheel.
"We'll keep following these bearings," Cook said. "They were going straight, and there's enough coal and food for a few days."
They had a wireless telegraph, but since there were no telegraph cables in the Pacific, it was useless. The only way to get a message to their master would be to take it to him themselves. They had received 1 last communication giving them coordinates for where they could flee to, if necessary. After 4 hours of travelling in the dark, a slight glow appeared on the horizon and grew gradually brighter.
"There she be, mate," Cook said.
In another 30 minutes, they were close enough to see an island with a large central building that seemed to be made from glass. Footman had seen the Crystal Palace in London and recognized this replica. Cook slowed the engine.
"We know the coordinates of the enemy now," Footman said. "We should leave."
"We could take a closer look," Cook answered. "This boat's got an anchor. How's your swimming these days?"
"I swim well," Footman said. "But I think we should get back to Mr. Socrates.
I'm the senior officer."
"Leadership was not delineated."
"Delineated?" Cook laughed. "Where'd you learn such fancy words?"
Cook pushed the anchor over the side, tied his shoes together, hung them around his neck, and jumped into the water. Footman sighed. Cook had been in the house for the last 5 years. Perhaps he had grown tired of boiling carrots for Mr. Socrates. He knew that the boat wouldn't be easy to find, so Footman followed him moments later. With his strong strokes, he easily caught up with Cook and passed him. The island had a beach and docks that were well-lit and well-guarded, so they swam around to the north, where rocky crags pushed out of the water. They swam for 30 minutes. The cold water was beginning to get into his bones, but the tiger and the dragon on his arms would keep him warm. Cook was huffing and puffing. He should have been trained more often. Footman led Cook to a protruding rock, and they clung to it to rest. The tide was at its lowest, the moon bright, showing that the rock walls were almost as smooth as glass. Perhaps they'd even been blasted to make them so smooth. They would be impossible to climb with bare hands.
"Looks like we'll have to go back to the boat,"
Cook said.
Too bad. Wait.
Footman pointed at a dark spot on the wall.
I think there is a cave over there.
They swam several yards until they were just below the mouth of the cave, then climbed up and into it. They had to crouch and crawl alternately to make their way inside. It had been pure luck that they'd seen it, Footman realized. An hour later and the tide would have covered the entrance. He turned on his pocket lucifer and followed the cave 30 feet or so into the island. It gradually sloped up and became drier. In time, they came upon a man-made tunnel.
We will not be able to leave this way when the tide rises, Footman said,
wringing the last of the salt water from his shirt tail.
Then let's not dilly-dally, mate.
Cook was shaking with cold. Footman climbed a ladder to another tunnel that led to several more tunnels. They chose one to follow and found that with each step they took, it stank more of decay and of vinegar. But they continued to work their way towards the surface, covering their noses with their hands. At the end of one tunnel, Cook found a trapdoor and pushed it up.
Land ahoy, he whispered,
poking his head up. Then, after a quick glance around, he crawled out. Footman followed, and they both sucked in fresh air. They were near the cliffs, looking down the island at a massive dock, a line of cannons pointing to the sea.
They are 16-pounders at least, Cook said. 12 of them. It would take an armada to storm this place.
The glass building at the center of the island glowed red, as though it were a living thing. Soldiers were walking to and fro in front of the gates, several pulling wagons of wood and brick. Even in the dead of night, there was work to be done. Footman spotted several huge hounds and guessed that these were the half-mechanical hounds Mr. Socrates had spoken about. One sniff of his or Cook's scent and the hounds would be on them, but the breeze was working in their favor, and they were far enough away to be safe.
Quite the setup, Cook whispered. Guns, hounds. I've counted at least 100 soldiers. If that's the night shift, then it must be like an anthill when the sun rises.
You talk too much, Footman said.
I'll keep me smackers closed.
As they explored the island, they stayed close to the huge rocks and were hidden by the surrounding shrubbery. They were about to step around a large rock formation when Footman noticed a cave mouth emitting light. He put his arm back to stop Cook and peered around the rim of the cave entrance. Inside, a white-haired man stood at a table, his back to Footman, measuring liquids into several flasks. Footman knew immediately that this was Dr. Hyde. He'd been briefed on all the enemies they might encounter. The doctor stood next to a long operating table. And was that an arm lying on it? And a torso? What horror was this? He poked his head farther around the rock and gasped. Along the back wall were hung half-finished men who looked stitched together. Tall, strong men. Their eyes closed. A green fog gathered around them, a gas emitted from several pipes. Footman pulled Cook in front of him so he could see.
Good Lord, Cook whispered. Let's get the seven hells out of here.
They slowly worked their way back towards the trapdoor. As he crept along, Footman took a measure of the place. The glass palace was at least 100 feet tall and 2,000 feet long. The logistics of transporting the materials to create it were mind-boggling. The massive dock, with its cranes and airship tower, could resupply the largest of warships. The entire island slanted down towards the dock on the east side so that all armaments could be fired towards the enemy. The cliffs protected them from the west. Cook led them around the central mountain of rocks, but as they approached the trapdoor, he stopped. A huge man was sitting on a stone, staring up at the moon. He turned his gaze to Footman and Cook.
I saw you climb out of this hole, he said.
His voice was ragged.
I waited for you to return.
The monster was expressionless, as though his face had frozen. His eyes glimmered with moonlight, but not much else. Footman had never been superstitious, but standing here under the moon, he believed he was looking at the undead.
You are intruders,
the thing said.
Intruders? Cook said. We're delivering coal, mate, that's all. We're lost.
The man stood. It was like watching a stone statue move.
No, you are too clever to be one of the soldiers.
They all drink of some pacifying tincture, and they wouldn't say mate. Therefore, you are from off-island and an enemy. If you run, the hounds will shred you to pieces. I haven't told anyone you're here. Just get past me, and you'll be free.
So it's a game for you, is it? Cook asked.
The man nodded.
A momentary entertainment.
Cook gave Footman a glance and raised his eyebrows. Footman saw the glint of daring in his friend's eyes.
Do not try...
Cook charged. He lowered his head and butted the man squarely in the chest, a move he had perhaps used in 100 brawls. The monster lifted him with a huge hand, flipped him over, and smashed him head first against a boulder. He was clearly dead. Footman never would have dreamed a man as strong as Cook could be swatted down like a fly.
You are smaller, the creature said. Perhaps not easier to kill. Please prove entertaining.
Footman had a knife in his pant leg, but he knew it would be useless. He reached inside his shirt and let out a small battle cry as he dashed towards his enemy. The man opened his arms as though to embrace him. At the last second, Footman flipped open the pocket lucifer, blinding him. At the same time, he leapt to one side and tried to race past. But he wasn't fast enough, and the monster struck him in the ribs a glancing blow that threw Footman several feet. He rolled along the stones, which cut into his skin, and leapt up, ignoring the pain.
Trapdoor ahead!
He measured the distance with his eyes. The monster pursued him with a bull-like speed. No time to think. He'd be crushed. So he ran past the trapdoor, towards the sound of the crashing waves, the rocks under his feet slick from the mist. He glanced back to see the monster at his heels, his own death at his heels. Footman ran to the edge of the cliff and dove into the Pacific.